studios of WRPI in Troy, New York. This is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 17 of Little Brother, dated 24th of August, 2001. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. All right, the show is Little Brother. The topic is technology. The name is Chuck Ritter. We can be reached here at the WRPI studios at area code 518-276-6248. So if you have an opinion on anything that you hear us talking about, anything that you've heard us talk about before, anything you want to talk about, anything you think I'm going to talk about, or just anything, give us a call, 518-276-6248. Need to let you know before we get started that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRPI staff or management, the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or the Rensselaer Student Union. Or for that matter, anybody else who may choose to claim them, although you can certainly agree with them, I don't mind that. So let's get started. I'm going to do something I don't normally do. Got an item here which actually relates not to the computer technology that I usually talk about, but rather broadcast technology and how it's being applied and how it's being abused. And as some of you in my listening audience know, and most of you should know, there is a radio station down in New York City, WBAI, and they've been having some terrible turmoil as of late. And the most recent attack has been against one of their prize-winning journalists named Amy Goodman, who has been fired, even though she is the hostess of a very popular and award-winning and very hard-edged program called Democracy Now!, which, amongst other places, does air on WRPI in Troy. And basically what happened is WBAI has shown her the door, and she has continued to produce Democracy Now! In exile. So fear not, it will continue to appear here on WRPI. However, I have this this release that came from the Pacifica campaign, which I'm going to read to you. Amy Goodman and the Democracy Now! Team have been suspended without pay for insisting on a violence-free workplace, and Democracy Now!, which is being produced from a safe site in Lower Manhattan and not Pacifica Station WBAI, has been yanked off the air. This is at WBAI, not at WRPI. We are still airing it. At WBAI, the Democracy Now! Staff have been physically and verbally attacked by interim station manager Utrecht Lead and other Lead loyalists. When Pacifica senior management ignored their repeated written requests that something be done about the intolerable atmosphere of intimidation and threats, they felt they had no choice but to fashion some interim solution last week and find a safe and secure workplace to produce the show. No worker should be forced to report to a job site where they are physically attacked by supervisors and where staff members go on the air to urge their physical destruction. Let's stand in solidarity with Democracy Now! On Tuesday, August 28th. What you can do. First, organize a solidarity protest in your local area. Choose your own local protest site. We recommend that if you have a Pacifica station or a corporate Pacifica board member in your town or one of its offices, like the National Association of Home Builders, Fannie Mae, or the anti-union firm of Epstein, Becker, and Green, then organize a protest at that site. Number two, please fax, email, or call or mail the individuals listed below. I'll get to that list in a moment. Contact them as many times as possible until you feel that your voice has been heard. Your phone calls are important. Keep the message straightforward. No profanity. No name-calling. Demand the immediate dismissals of Pacifica Executive Director Bessie Wash and the WBAI Station Manager Utrecht Lead. The Pacifica campaign will organize a national call-in for Tuesday, August 28th. Third, make a contribution to the Pacifica Campaign, a grassroots organization representing listeners and staff alike, fighting to preserve Pacifica's 50-year tradition of progressive community-based radio. Tax-deductible contributions may be made to the fiscal sponsor, a 501c3 organization. Make checks payable to the Institute for Media Analysis, Pacifica Campaign. The mailing address, Pacifica Campaign, 51 McDougal Street, number 80, New York, New York, 10012. That address again is the Pacifica Campaign, 51 McDougal Street, number 80, New York, New York, 10012. Who to contact? Contact AFTRA headquarters today and ask to speak to Union President Greg Hessinger. The AFTRA National Office telephone number is 212-532-0800. The fax number is 212-532-2242. Or email him at ghessing@aftra.com. That's ghessing@aftra.com. Tell Greg Hessinger that Amy Goodman and the Democracy Now! Staff should not be forced to report to a job site where they are physically attacked by supervisors and where staff members go on the air to urge their physical destruction. That is fascism, not democracy, and no union should collaborate with such policies. Pacifica Board Vice Chair Ken Ford can be contacted at 800-368-5242, extension 228. Can also be phoned at 301-350-6388. His fax is 202-822-0369, and his email addresses are kenfordpacifica@aol.com and kford@nahb.com. Ken Ford's boss at the National Association of Home Builders is Jerry Howard. His number is 800-368-5242, extension 257. His email address, jhoward@nahb.com. Ask that the NAHB's Ken Ford resign from the Pacifica Board today. Pacifica Board member Valerie Chambers can be reached at 361-825-6012. Her fax number is 281-655-0266. She can be emailed at Valerie Chambers, that's Valerie.Chambers, at mail.tamucc.edu. That's Valerie.Chambers@mail.tamucc.edu. Pacifica Board member Wendell L. Johns can be reached at 202-752-5355. His fax number is 202-752-4281. His email address is Wendell_L_Johns@FannieMae, that's FannieMae.com. Pacifica Board member Bob Farrell can be reached at 310-514-2052. His email address is alfigo@aol.com. Once again, contact those people. Tell them that you're fed up with the nonsense going on at WBAI. All right, now back to our normal business. The show's little brother, your phone calls are appreciated. Area code 518-276-6248. We have our usual entries from the Risks Digest on comp.risks on Usenet. First item comes from Paul G. Newman. He says, a study from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston in the Journal of the American Medical Association reports that over the 10-year period ending December 2000, 42 recalls and 10 safety alerts were issued for pacemakers and implanted cardioverter defibrillators, or ICDs, as in Dick Cheney. Involving more than 520,000 devices, over 600,000 Americans have pacemakers and 150,000 have ICDs. So that represents a remarkably high percentage. However, only a small fraction of the recalled devices were actually defective. If recall recommendations were followed, the study estimates that 36,000 devices would have been replaced. Only a few deaths were attributed to malfunctions. Advisories are increasing, but that's attributed to increasing manufacturer vigilance and richer information output by the devices. Let's see here. Got an item from... another one from Peter Newman. A little reverse Rube Goldberg. The heat wave in the Washington, D.C. area caused a power outage. The backup batteries failed for Singular Wireless, and the automatic system that should have cut over to the backup generator also failed, resulting in a disruption of cell phone service to area codes 301 and 202, Singular Wireless customers. The failure of a single switch that was supposed to transfer from batteries to generator power, which was designed to operate autonomously for at least a month, was apparently the ultimate limiting factor. But the generator ran fine. Amazing. This one comes from Andre Opperman. On Friday, July 27th, 2001, the whole Swisscom Mobile GSM network, serving 3.3 million customers at 70% of the market share in Switzerland, broke down for 10 hours from 12:30 until about 22:30 GMT plus 2 hours. Two independent software errors in the primary and backup network signaling processors, the SS7 network, caused a halt for processing of all signaling in a GSM network. This includes call setup, call receiving, SMS, logging onto network, and basically everything else. The central GSM systems stayed on, but were unable to communicate with base stations in the field. The primary system suffered a complete failure, and as designed, the backup system took over. While it was working fine first, the backup system got loaded in more and more, judging from the description, something like missing free call, and eventually broke down. It too broke down about a half hour later. The newspaper Le Monde was reporting insider information last week saying that these signaling processors are made by Alcatel. Then Alcatel found out about the software errors 2 weeks before and probably also had a fix, but forgot to inform Swisscom Mobile about it. Alcatel is now facing a 30 million Swiss franc liability case. This is the loss Swisscom Mobile has because of lost revenues, not including public image damages. In one thing I have respect for Swisscom, they did a pretty good job with public relations, informed the media and public very openly about their technical problems. Now, 2 weeks later, Swisscom Mobile also issued a thought written for the non-technician but pretty detailed press release of the cause and events of this network failure. Although one funny thing happened, the press release in German is the original one, and while translating in English, they forgot just one word, but it makes a somewhat significant difference. The German version reads, "Technical systems do not guarantee 100% availability, but we do our best to get 99.95%. In the English version, it reads, "Technical systems guarantee 100% availability, but we do our best to get 99.95%. Very amusing. Let's see. Michigan State Police detective whose estranged wife was shot dead at the Potter Park Zoo admitted using police databases such as the Law Enforcement Information Network to check on his wife and her acquaintances before her fatal shooting. That comes from the Free Press on August 8, 2001. Let's see here. We have a story of sequential bugs, or at least odd behavior. This one comes to us from Steve Billovin of AT&T. Last March, someone entered a rate of $0 per night for the Mexico City Airport Hilton into an online reservation system. A number of users of the Travelocity website saw it and reserved rooms. Hilton eventually agreed to honor that rate for one night and let travelers stay additional nights at the lowest available rate. But the story has gotten even stranger. According to today's Wall Street Journal, at least two people who made such reservations via Travelocity have found that the reservations have been canceled without their knowledge. Hilton and Travelocity deny any knowledge of what happened. Both cancellations were via telephone calls to Travelocity made within minutes of each other. Steve Holsworth writes to us that in an article from a Charlotte, North Carolina newspaper, they are interested in putting up some closed-circuit TV cameras around the state along the highways. The cameras will be used to photograph the license tags of some 400,000 vehicles so researchers can analyze freeway travel and predict future air pollution levels and highway speeds. The 43 cameras will photograph and track every car that passes on stretches of U.S. 74 and Interstate 77 and 85 during a 12-hour period. North Carolina highway officials say the photos will be destroyed within 90 days to protect the drivers. Interesting possibility if the numbers and letters could be read, but the state identification couldn't, in which case somebody in North Carolina could potentially get a ticket based on somebody's license plate who came from Alaska. This item comes from Andrew Hilburn. It says, 2.5 years ago, I received an unexpected telephone call about 10:30 at night on my British Telecom phone. The caller was adamant that I had called him at about 20 minutes after 10 the same night from my phone. He just used 1471 when he arrived home himself to access the caller ID of the last call to his number. But I had been out of the house until 10 o'clock, and the house had been empty. It took some effort to persuade my unknown caller that I hadn't called him earlier that evening. So the following day, I asked the BT fault reporting line how this could have happened. I was told that this sort of thing happens quite often. I may have been in trouble if a crime had been committed at the other house that night. BT, don't advertise this failure mode at all. Okay, we have an item from Michael Loftus. He says, I see that Hotmail has junk spam filters, and I get a fair amount of spam in my Hotmail account, so I figure I'll give it a try. It doesn't block anything that's spam. In fact, the only thing it did block was in the low setting was mailings from Speakeasy, my internet service provider, even after I told it that I wanted those. It's a good thing I noticed they send their bills via email also. I mean, really, I got 3 to 4 pieces of spam through the filter, even after saying one of them was spam earlier. And 5 to 6 pieces of mail from Speakeasy went into the junk folder with the filter, so I turned it off. The risk is twofold. Blocking very obvious non-bulk mailings via a mechanism that isn't obvious, and then telling the user that they can ask that the mechanism be circumvented in certain special cases, but then not implementing it. Imagine if I had not looked into the junk mail folder. How much other legitimate email would be in there? Keep in mind, this was on the low setting. And actually, I have a comment on this myself. And that is that I've noticed that a very great quantity of spam actually originates from Hotmail.com for obvious reasons. It's something that anybody can run in and set up for free and can pretty much get away with setting up as many as they want. Sure, there's an end-user license agreement, but how many people are actually following the agreement? And if Hotmail comes along and takes your account away, you go make another one. Big deal. I don't know. Let's see. Martin Schulze writes, modern cars may contain GPS systems to guide the driver to unknown destination locations that he would otherwise have to use a map for. We went out with three cars of which two were sold with such a GPS system. Ours wasn't, but we were driving in a city that I know best. Both cars with GPS systems didn't know that city well enough to reach the destination location without a map or a GPS system. After lunch at a restaurant at a distant edge of the city, we went back to the house. Right after leaving the restaurant, the three cars diverted using different paths. Our car, without the GPS, and one other car arrived at the house early. We were wondering where the third car had gone. Finally, some 10 minutes later, they arrived as well. What was the reason? Too much trust in depending on modern computer thingies. The location was stored in the GPS system. In order to reuse the location, it was stored by using letters, but unfortunately, the display wasn't very wide. When storing the name of the city and some random string, the system cut off some parts. So you have, for example, Wilhelmshaven Hotel, Wilhelmshaven House, Wilhelmshaven Restaurant. And what happened is the display cut it off right after the N in Wilhelmshaven. Thus, you couldn't read whether it was hotel, house, or restaurant. So, when reselecting the destination after lunch, the driver had to make the choice of which of the three similar-looking locations is the proper one. He'd selected the wrong one, so the GPS system guided him to the hotel instead of the house. This driver used the GPS system of a modern Volkswagen Passat. The other car was an Audi 100, which has a larger display for the GPS system, so the driver was guided to the correct address. Listening to Little Brother. I'm going to take a brief break here. We'll be right back. Prodigy from the Matrix soundtrack. You're listening to Little Brother. And we have one here for the Let No Good Deed Go Unpunished file. But before I bring it to you, I'm going to remind you of the phone numbers. Area code 518-276-6248 is our phone number. Please feel free to call in with your opinions. A good deed may lead to prosecution for Brian K. West, a 24-year-old sales and support employee for an internet service provider in southeast Oklahoma. Mr. West has become a statistic for the computer analysis response team because he alerted a local business to a serious security flaw in their website. On February 1st, 2000, one of West's co-workers created a banner advertisement to be placed on the Pato Daily News website as part of a legitimate advertising campaign for his employer. To test how his finished ad would look on the site, West clicked the Edit button on Microsoft's Internet Explorer. This action brought up Microsoft's front page and should have created a local copy of the webpage, allowing West to do a mock-up of the site on his own computer. In this case, however, Microsoft's front page displayed some unusual files due to a server misconfiguration. After some confusion, West realized that the web server hosting the Poto Daily News required no authentication to edit any file on the site. A lack of authentication meant that anybody could edit the Poto Daily News website by using front page without ever having to provide a password. Clearly, this is a massive security hole. On February 2nd, after testing the hole to make sure there really was a problem, Brian West contacted the editor-in-chief of the Poto Daily News, Wally Burchett, to tell him about the problem with his company's website. He did this even though the site was hosted by CyberLink, a company that in direct competition with his own employer. West mentioned the flaws in the CyberLink web server to Mr. Burchett. When he did, Mr. Burchett became very upset and said he'd call West back. When Mr. Burchett called back, he recorded the call and asked for details on the server problem. In the course of explaining the problem, West let Mr. Burchett know that other companies, including West's own bank, had experienced similar problems configuring server software. Following their phone conversation, Mr. Burchett gave the tape to the Poto Police Department, and that's when the FBI got involved. The FBI posed as employees of the Poté Daily News and asked West about dedicated Internet access, T1 or better. They called for the best time to visit him at CWIS Internet Services, the company where he works. After setting up a meeting, the FBI arrived on February 11, 2000. When the FBI, posing as the main office of the Poté Daily News, asked about the problem with PDNS.com site, West explained the details regarding the PDNS.com website, including how to fix the server misconfiguration. At that time, he did not know that they were FBI agents. As part of his explanation, West clicked Edit in IE to show how the bug worked. As it happened, the site was still wide open 2 weeks after he had explained the problem and how to fix it to the editor-in-chief of the paper, Wally Burchett. After the explanation, one of the agents claimed he needed to get something out of his car. When he left, a different agent showed up with a badge and a search warrant. West and the others cooperated with the FBI agents in the search. The FBI spent all day taking data. They also refused to promptly provide a copy of the search warrant when one was repeatedly requested. Almost 16 months after the FBI searched Mr. West's workplace, a U.S. prosecuting attorney in Muskogee, Oklahoma, called his lawyer stating that they wanted him to accept a felony conviction and 5 years probation. Brian K. West has yet to be charged or convicted of any crimes, yet the prosecutor claims that if he doesn't get convicted under Title 18, Section 1030 of the U.S. Code, then the prosecutor would try for wire fraud. Brian K. West, who did nothing more than try to get a local copy of an HTML document to pretest how an ad would look on a web page using Microsoft Front Page, may well have his reputation destroyed and his finances ruined as a result of his actions. He did not deface the site. He did not damage anything. He accidentally found a security hole, tested it to make sure it was real, and then called the owner of the site to inform him of the problem. In short, West faces a felony conviction for telling the Poté Daily News that he discovered that there was a serious misconfiguration in their server. Absolutely unbelievable. Come on, people, you should be getting angry about this. Give me a call, 518-276-6248. I want to hear from you. Okay, what else do we have here? Okay, this is an item that came out of the Chicago Tribune. A federal jury Tuesday found that Customs Service inspectors intentionally inflicted emotional distress by strip-searching a former Chicago woman at O'Hare International Airport and recommended she be awarded almost $130,000 in damages. The decision isn't binding on U.S. District Judge Rebecca Pallmeyer, though she told jurors that she would consider their verdict very seriously in reaching her own decision in several weeks. One juror, Roger Smith Sr., described the 5.5-hour deliberations as a dogfight and said the women of the panel were upset that inspectors made Kate Caniff strip off and bend over to see whether she had hidden narcotics in her body. That weighed heavily on the women, Smith said, as he left the Dirksen Federal Building after the verdict Tuesday evening. Prosecutors contended that the inspectors were just doing their jobs when they patted down Caniff, strip-searched her, and sent her to a hospital for an X-ray after she returned by jet to O'Hare from a 4-day camping trip to Jamaica. Inspectors alleged a drug-sniffing dog alerted on her and that a number of her answers raised suspicions that she might be smuggling drugs. No contraband was found. Caniff, 36, of Washington Island, Wisconsin, wept when the judge announced the verdict of the four-man, four-woman jury of the civil trial. Thank God, she said moments later outside the courtroom. I'm just really thankful that they were listening. Those people intentionally hurt me, she said of the inspectors. Maybe they didn't knowingly hurt me, but they really didn't care. That's what I get from this. But in a rare occurrence in federal court, the jury's verdict is only advisory. Caniff's suit was brought under tort laws that don't entitle defendants who sue the U.S. government to a jury trial, according to lawyers in the case. Both sides agreed to hold the trial before Pallmeyer and an advisory jury, but the jury didn't know of its advisory role until Pallmeyer told them moments before announcing its verdict. Pallmeyer said, asked for legal briefs from both sides in 2 weeks, but set no timetable for her decision. In closing arguments Tuesday, plaintiff's lawyers, Paul Schindler and Deirdre Bowman, sought $200,000 in damages. Jurors sided with Caniff on all legal fronts, finding that inspectors lacked reasonable suspicion to conduct a strip search, that their conduct was willful and wanton, that they subjected Caniff to false imprisonment, and that they intentionally inflicted emotional distress. They then imposed damages totaling $129,750, $112,625 for emotional pain and suffering, and $17,125 for future psychiatric care. Juror Smith said he was sympathetic with the trauma that Caniff went through, but he also defended the difficult and important job that inspectors must do to try to keep narcotics from entering at O'Hare. He called the verdict a compromise. The women jurors felt that the inspectors should have gone from a pat-down search straight to the x-ray, skipping the intrusive strip search, according to Smith. Some jurors don't think Caniff's suit was about money, concluding from the testimony that her parents, who attended each day of the 7-day trial, were already wealthy, Smith said. Other jurors also questioned the veracity of the testimony of the inspector, who said she felt something in Caniff's crotch area while patting her down. They also thought the inspector, Olga Martinez, testified with a smirk on her face. He said, "I don't see it," Smith said. Caniff had testified that Martinez and a second inspector who witnessed the strip search had smirks on their faces after she pulled her pants back up. Prosecutors defended the actions of the inspectors, saying they grew suspicious at Caniff's answers, including that she had paid cash for her airline ticket shortly before her trip, didn't stay at a hotel, and was evasive about who was picking her up. In his closing argument, Schindler, one of Caniff's lawyers, called the inspectors poorly trained, careless, and very aggressive. But during a break in the trial Tuesday, Robin Dessar, Customs Services Director at O'Hare, said the inspectors acted appropriately and professionally. I'm sorry, I don't buy it. I just don't buy it. Let's talk about the points about which this woman's answers were considered suspicious. For starters, let's talk about paying for an airline ticket in cash. I grant, it is a lot of cash to carry around. Hey, I have a caller. Let's see who we have on the line. Hello, caller. You're on Little Brother.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I listened to you. I've been listening to your whole program, including your discussion with your friends who are on the way home.
Oh, okay. That was actually the preceding program that was the discussion with the others.
Oh.
That program was off the hook. That originates out of WBAI in New York,
I rerun
it on Saturday nights.
Well, I'm sorry to confuse you.
That's quite all right.
Yeah, you're right. People should be getting mad and calling, at least calling you and thanking you for telling us about these things. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, this is less important, but when you introduce your program, you say that it's a program about, among other things, what happens when high technology gets together with low intelligence or something
like that? Yes, it's a show about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is fine, except I think it doesn't sound quite right, the low intelligence thing, because I don't think it's true, although I understand your point and I agree with it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think that high technology and low motives is much more accurate. There are plenty of people who are using high technology that have very high intelligence. That what's wrong with them is their motives.
You know, I like that. It's not something that I had thought of previously, and I think you're absolutely right. Actually, now that I think about it, because. If you've listened to my show at any great length, you know that that Bill Gates is one of my favorite whipping boys.
But the first person I thought of, yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, you're right. He is not an idiot.
Oh, no.
No, he's not.
No.
But he is greedy. There's no question about that.
Yeah. And he has the technology at his fingertips, so to speak.
Well, most certainly he does. And one of the concerns that... That I raise repeatedly, not just here, but in casual conversation as well, is that quite frequently Microsoft security is an oxymoron, and as was demonstrated by the case of the web developer that I read about just a minute ago there.
In the Midwest?
Yes, he was in Oklahoma. Brian West is his name.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I had something that I wanted to raise in connection with that.
Absolutely.
That you raised, too, and also in connection with, in connection with that case and the case of the strip search.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of ties them together, did you happen to read in the New York Times Magazine about 6 months ago, there was a piece about a former Central Intelligence Agency chief named James Wolfson, or Woolsey? Did you happen to see that or hear about it?
I regret that I didn't read the piece. However, even if I had, I would probably ask you to recap it so that we can fill other listeners in.
All right. Well, it was a case similar to the strip search of the woman who was out of the country for 4 days, in that it involved the INS. What happened was, I think it was maybe 1996, I think, was when James Woolsey now got involved in it. Now, let me tell you who he is. He was the head of the CIA first under, he was brought in by the Bush administration, Bush 42, I guess it is. Padre Bush, and then he stayed on when Clinton came in, and he was in there, so I guess for a total of 2 or 3 years, he was the head of the CIA, whatever that's called, the director.
It is the director, I believe.
Right, director of the CIA. Now, obviously, such a person, and you can just tell from his WASP name, James Woolsey, that he was recruited right out of the haute establishment, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
In the United States, and had a long history of involvement in the security establishment, and then he was selected by none other than George Bush to head the CIA. So a person with impeccable right-wing credentials. Anyway, so he decides to leave the CIA because he said he was really kind of bored, and he went back into private life. And anyway, after the Iraq slaughter. A friend of his called him, another lawyer, because Woolsey is a lawyer too, called him because his friend knew that he had connections, high government connections, to help him on a case involving some Iraqi citizens who had been brought to the United States by the United States Air Force in the aftermath of the Desert Slaughter.
Desert Scam, as I like to call it.
Yeah, Desert Slaughter, whatever. They were brought here in conjunction with the activities that the CIA and the NSA and so on and the American military were conducting to support internal resistance to Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
That they were trying to organize to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Now, anyway, so there was a lot of things going on. In conjunction with that, three or four Iraqi men who were involved in the resistance in some way were brought to the United States for presumably.
I would have to assume it was for training of some sort.
Or to get them out of the line of fire temporarily. Yeah. And to train them and then to send them back, but they had no reason to think that they were being brought here for any other reason. They hadn't run afoul of the American government, far from it. They had been working with it, and so anyway, shortly after getting here, they were thrown into the INS detention center in California. And I don't know if it was San Francisco or where, L.A., but. They were thrown in there, and they weren't told why. And they were somehow able to get a hold of a lawyer to try to figure out to help them get out. And this lawyer happened to have connections which went all the way to this guy Woolsey, who was the ex-head of the CIA, and contacted him. And what this lawyer told Woolsey, this friend of Woolsey was that these Iraqis had not been told anything. They had not been given any reason for their detention. They were accused of entering the country illegally.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, as I said earlier, they were brought in by the American Air Force.
Well, of course,
on an Air Force plane. But other than that, there were no charges had been made against him, and consequently, except this one, which the Iraqis said was false, and so anyway, the lawyer was at a loss to what to do. There were no charges being made. He couldn't defend them because against what?
They'd fallen into a legal loophole, which unfortunately exists, and one which has been talked about before. Not here in this program, but on this station at least.
No, there wasn't any loophole. I understand what you mean, but mm-hmm. there is no such loophole.
Well, maybe not a loophole. It's more sort of a limbo.
Well, what they've fallen into is the truth.
Yes,
about the American legal system and the American system of supposed rights. But let me continue.
I'm going to ask you to wrap it up because I have another caller on the line here.
Okay. Well, Woolsey got involved in the case, and he ran up against the same brick wall that this lawyer did, even though Woolsey's credentials were very powerful, and he says in this article in the New York Times, this is a fascist country.
Yes.
This is the person who was the head of the CIA not less than 10 years ago. This is a fascist country. I mean, this guy is like, and if you look at him, there's a picture. He looks like, you know, classic American blue blood.
Well, sure. I heard a rather interesting speech, and I really wish I could remember who it was because it was downloadable off of the Internet. But it basically tore it down how this country came to be this way. And I'd love to find it and play it sometime. I'll have to work on that when I get home
tonight.
Well,
Noam Chomsky, I think, has that down pretty well. Don't you?
You're right. I don't think it was him, though. I think it was...
If you can't find the other one, just, you know...
Go for Noam Chomsky.
Absolutely. He's got it laid out, you know, in the most meticulous way.
Yes. All right. Well, thank you very much for calling.
Okay. Thanks for having the show. Bye.
All right. Take care. And, of course, if you would like to add your voice to the mix, the phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. So let's see who else we have on the line. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Little Sister.
Oh, no.
Deeply disappointed not to be on the air this week, so I had to call the show. You know, and I was listening to your story about the strip search.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely appalling.
Mm-hmm.
Of course,
absolutely.
But, you know, now that I know that it's professional and appropriate to force people to strip search, I can't wait to go to work on Monday. I just can't wait.
Well, I had a couple of points I had been going to make about what the suspicion that this person supposedly fell under.
Oh, I know. When I went to England, we didn't have a place to stay planned in advance.
No, absolutely.
That shouldn't put you under suspicion.
And let me ask you, did you pay cash for your tickets?
No, we did buy them on the Internet.
Oh, okay. No, well, that changes a little bit. But I have in front of me a $1 bill, and I'm reading on it,
legal tender.
Just to the left of George Washington's face, it says, "This note is legal tender for all debts, public and private."
Mm-hmm.
For that reason, there is absolutely no reason why paying for something with these pieces of paper right here that say this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, there's absolutely no reason why that should be a cause for suspicion.
No reason whatsoever, no, except for our own prejudices. I mean, it is unfortunate that, yes, a lot of people that, are legally shady do use cash, but, you know, there's a lot of us that are perfectly innocent that don't have credit cards. I don't have a credit card. You know, Phil bought the tickets online.
Well, sure. Hang on just a second here. Keep going.
But, yeah, it's absolutely appalling. When we went to London, I am so glad I hadn't heard this story beforehand because I would have had a conniption fit on the way over. I would have looked so nervous they would have strip-searched me for sure.
Yep, I understand.
The guy did question us quite a lot when he found out that we didn't have a place prearranged to stay. what happened was, and let this be a lesson to your listeners, what happened was that he was questioning Phil because at the time Phil had purple hair. So he also...
Oh, that's always a dead giveaway.
Yes, he looked a little suspicious to him. And what I did, this is what I did. I put up a big offended front and acted absolutely professional. He asked me what I did for a living. I told him I was an administrator at a mental health association in the United States, and he let us through 2 seconds later.
Interesting.
All you have to do is just act offended, act as if he doesn't know who he's talking to, and they just let you go.
Okay. Well, I have another caller here, so
okay,
I'm going
to let you go.
Pop off for now, all right?
Okay. It's been a good show.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
Let's see who our next caller is. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. I just heard you complaining about customs agents or talking about customs agents and so on, and I thought I'd share a story.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see. If memory serves, you've been overseas to Asia several times, correct?
Well, this is my ex-wife's story, and she's actually from there.
Okay.
But she went home to visit and started mailing all these things to this country. And you know what? She made a mistake that I'm... Do not put mothballs in your things that you ship from overseas.
Okay.
They mess with the drug dog's ability to smell. Seriously? It sets off warning flags for all the customs people when their dog comes up and can't smell what's in the package.
Uh-huh.
So they, like, dug through all her old clothes and all her underwear, and then they found, like, some virtually irreplaceable souvenir-type things and, like, literally sliced them open, destroying them in the process to make sure there was no opiates or something in there, because she was coming from Taiwan, which I believe is a transaction point for opium shipments, you know, where it's not a source country, but it's often, I think, shipped through there.
Right. Well, obviously, in the case of this particular poor woman who was strip-searched, she was coming from Jamaica. It's an unfortunate stereotype, but what's the first thing you think of? Rastafarians and pot.
Not only that, the point where she finally snapped, meeting my ex-wife, is when the Customs Service tried to send us a bill for not paying the proper customs fees.
Right.
At which point she called up the senator and is screaming, "They sliced up my toy turtle and now they're trying to charge me money for it!"
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And the senator, who was at McNulty, made some calls and
I'll tell you
said, we won't charge you for destroying your property.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely not. There's no way they should. And I've had run-ins with customs agents myself. I had one I had one particular trip I had taken to England on business, and I had absolutely no trouble getting into the country, getting into England. I walked over there. They said, "What are you here for?" I said, "I'm here on business." They said, "All right, well," and stamped my passport and said, "Have a nice day, sir," and that was the end of it. I come back to the U.S., and I was there on business. I didn't buy any souvenirs. I came up to the customs agent in the U.S., and I said, "I have nothing to declare." And he looked at me funny. "You've been to England for a week and a half, and you have nothing to declare. Not a pack of gum, not a pack of cigarettes, nothing." I said, "No, nothing." "All right, fine. I bought a pack of antacids for dealing with petty bureaucrats like yourself." That was the end of the argument.
And then he let you through?
They did let me through. It's rather like what the previous caller was discussing, where you have to act offended.
Well, I remember one time when I was in college driving into this country from Canada, and we were in cars, and my friend who was studying it, this explains it all. He was an RPI student studying for a computer science degree.
Mm-hmm.
He forgot where he was born.
Oh.
And the customs people are like, "Where are you born?" And he's going, "New York." "No, Maryland." "Maryland, New York." No, Maryland, Maryland. And they're looking at him. They said, "Pull over."
Oh, dear.
And then they made me get out of my car and searched. I was very scared because they left him with the car to answer any questions about what was in my car. He said they gave him a great first aid quiz as they dug through my first aid kit saying, "What's this for? What's this for?" And he's going, "Let me see. He's the EMT, not me. I think that's for aluminum foil. I think that's for sucking chest wounds."
Wonderful.
Back in the car, I said, "Yes, that is what it was for." And he said, "Oh, they looked inside the aluminum foil. Well, there was nothing in there." But anyway, it's those nasty customs people.
Yeah. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you were the listener who emailed me that article in the first place. Is that correct?
I think so. I know. Okay. I thought about emailing it to you.
Okay. I believe you were. at any rate, you know, if this turns into a show about customs horror stories, the last remaining 10 minutes of it, so be it. I'm happy to talk about this issue. And,
well, it's most certainly a privacy concern.
Well, sure it is. I would think that once one has entered the country and established U.S. citizenship, immediately, with no further delay, all of your rights should immediately kick in. That includes the right not to be subjected to an unreasonable search.
Well, one thing that is interesting with the Internet and such is, shifting the topic somewhat, is, you know, although we have free speech in this country, I was surprised when a friend of mine told me that he could not get many publications shipped to him from overseas because the State Department wouldn't let him. He was a political junk mail collector.
Yeah.
And he would, this was in the 80s before the Internet existed, and he would just send off for, you know, one day he'd send off for communist literature, the next day it'd be extreme right-wing literature, and, you know, just collect it all. And they would not let him get anything from Libya, for instance.
Mm.
You know, he was sending off to Gaddafi saying, send me your stuff, and the customs like, hold it, you can't have this. You're not the customs, the State Department. He's like, well, why can't I read stuff from Libya? They're like, because you're not allowed. You know, I would think that would be protected by the First Amendment, but apparently not.
No, because it's not in the country. Until it's in the country, it doesn't cover it. Well, I have another caller here, so
okay.
I'm going to move on, all right?
Thank you.
All right, thank you for calling. Hello, caller. You're on WRPI.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Are we in the air?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Before I comment on the customs, I was wondering if you could give me a little information about the segment you had earlier on the Pacifica radio.
Absolutely, sure. What can I tell you?
Well, I got in just as you said something about resignations and then started giving out telephone numbers of
This was not a resignation. This was a firing. Amy Goodman was fired.
Today?
Let me see here.
I heard her this morning.
Oh, absolutely. You heard her this morning. You heard her here, right? On WRPI? Yeah.
Yeah.
She's been continuing to produce her program from Manhattan, from her own facilities.
And she's maintaining she has rights to the name, huh?
Apparently so, because it's been continuing to come through, and some stations, including ours, have been bold enough to carry it.
Well, by the way, I thank you for that.
Well, I can't accept it personally, but on behalf of WRPI,
thank WRPI for me. How's that?
Okay.
So that's what the latest news is. Then that she's been fired.
That's my understanding of the situation. And please bear in mind that I may stand corrected on that detail. All right.
Okay.
But the fact of the matter is, she isn't going to WBAI to do the program. She is doing the program from her own facilities.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah,
she's doing the program
like
in exile.
Monday, I think. It started last week, and Monday they brought her in to negotiate, and I hadn't heard what had happened since then, but I knew she was on this morning.
Right. And I regret that I'm short on details on that one.
That's all right.
At any rate, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. That's all, because I just wondered if something good might have happened instead of something bad. Like one of the jerks had finally packed it in or something.
We wish.
Yeah. Just a quick comment on your customs thing. So I'm not going to tell you customs stories, but, you know, the concept that somebody pays cash and doesn't make reservations, some people may, just for the sake of privacy, not want to broadcast where they're going.
Absolutely.
I don't own a cellular phone, nor would I put a trip computer in my car,
mm-hmm.
because that means a corporation and knows my whereabouts every minute that damn thing is on.
Oh, absolutely. Now, in my case, I didn't take it quite to that level. I do own one, a cellular phone, that is.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is,
I hope you turn it off once in a while just to throw them off.
Oh, sure. But I was mostly concerned about the privacy of my conversations, and so I waited until such time as encrypted cellular phones were available.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the digital ones fit that description.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And I think we're pretty much up against the clock here. The next shift is in and getting set up and ready to roll here. So we're going to close with this from the Beatles. You've been listening to Little Brother on WRPI, Troy.